inflation is much more hidden. It's much more difficult to discern. If you're using the CPI, I think they'll show that it's under control. The CPI is a bit of a farce in the calculation, though. It's a Frankenstein number that doesn't really represent real life. And that's by design. They've changed it over 24 times over the years. And every time it results in a lower calculation. Shocker.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk-takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. Today on the show, the pleasure of speaking with a good friend of mine, Bruce Fraser. Now, Bruce is the managing partner of Elkhorn Capital Partners and is a seasoned investor with over two decades of experience. He's a former hedge fund manager, and Bruce built his career on a disciplined, macro-driven investment approach that has successfully guided nearly $1 billion in assets under management today. He navigated the 2008 financial crisis by exiting real estate ahead of the downturn and later re-entered the market to build Elkhorn's portfolio today. He's now specializing in distress acquisitions and value-add strategies that not only deliver strong returns, but also improve housing for work-class housing communities in Oklahoma. Bruce holds both a BS in commerce and an MBA in finance from Southern Methodist University. I'm really pumped and excited to have him on the show today to share his incredible experience. But enough out of me. Well, let's welcome you out here. G'day, Bruce. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today, mate?
Hey, Reid. Good to see you.
Mate, you are I can consider you a friend. Very wise.
Oh, for sure.
Wise friends that we talk once a month on our mastermind. But before we get into the topic of today, I want to hear a little bit more about your background. I've known you for many years, and I just read out that you're a hedge fund manager. But how did you get into the space of managing money or investing and all that sort of stuff early on, coming out of uni?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a question many people have asked me. But I grew up in a family that was always spent beyond their means. And so I was focused on making money and saving and investing at a really early age, and started reading everything I could, and outgrew Money Magazine at 12 or 13, and started getting into much more quantitative stuff. It just interested me because I thought the stock market was a way where, if you could figure out how to build a better mousetrap, you could create wealth rapidly. And so I just started I thought a lot about it. And while I was in grad school, had a prof that, two really significant profs actually, but related to investment management. One of them was a derivatives prof. And he felt that as long as we got familiar with one or two tools, a handful of tools in our tool belt, that we could be consistent money makers with that. He didn't think that, you need to know all of it. I mean, although we had to for the exams, right? But we had a project where we had to paper trade a strategy for the entire semester and part of our grade side of that. And so I honed in on a particular strategy. It was actually selling option premium as opposed to on a hedge basis, as opposed to betting on something directional. And so you're really not correlated to anything. It's just time going by. And so, and you try to figure out what's not going to happen with what's going to stay within a 3-standard deviation move and place your bets accordingly. And, just really consistently made returns for a decade plus, and including through the financial crisis. Peak to trough, our drawdown was, I think, two and change. And we were, 2-20 fund. And so, on a gross basis, we're basically flat. And so, at the troughs of 2009, we're at our all-time highs. And when that happened, people were asking me, what else do you do with your model? And those other guys minus 60 and you're at your highs. And it wasn't because you bet on this, you just didn't get hit. And so, I had been heavily investing in real estate with one business partner during the hedge fund days, just smaller stuff. But, we had sold everything in late 07, as I think you mentioned, all of our investment property, and which, it, looking back, was well timed, obviously, but it wasn't a guess. I mean, we were just running a bunch of numbers, price to rent ratios, and how much you're paying for every dollar of income you're making, things like that. It was hyperbolic. And so felt like it was time to take our chips and go home, and started Elkhorn in 2010, 2011, largely because of my views coming out of the financial crisis and what happened. I knew the Fed was going to have to print a bunch of money, and you and I talked about this talked about this for probably over a decade, off and on. But felt like it was going to print a lot of money, which would be highly inflationary and debase the currency. And so I really wanted to focus a lot of my time on hard assets. And so first couple of years, banks weren't lending because they were still heavily damaged in the GFC and weren't really lending. So the first couple of years was really everything we were doing was cash. And so the smaller deals, buying some bank assets, doing some hard money lending. But a couple of years in, banks were lending again, and we became singularly focused at that time on multifamily and have been ever since. It's just what we do.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting that, you know, we get a fair few people on the show talking about the differences of 08 and the scars that they have or don't have. And I think the natural
next PTSD.
PTSD. But the natural next question is, you know, what similarities, you know, being a more of a newer sponsor, you know, I started RSN back in 2014, but I wasn't going through the 08 crash. But some of the last couple of years has felt very similar. Frothiness, banks, you know, taking, you know, we've had a myriad of issues that we can point to as not one thing is, but it's all sort of like there's been a lot of black swan events that have led to a slowdown and a correction, and we're in the correction right now. And but did, like, could you see any similarities between the two of the slowdown that we're having recently?
I mean, yeah, I think there's similarities and differences. This one was, you know, we're not through it yet, but this particular slowdown was not really catalyzed by a systemic event. You know, we had Bear Stearns fail. We had several other large multinational institutions that were truly just failing because of counterparty risk, and it was a chain reaction at the time. And it felt like the whole system is going to come apart, frankly. I mean, I had the only position I had on in my fund going into the February, March were long S&P puts. And it wasn't a big bet because we weren't a global bank or fund, but we were benefiting from that decline. And I actually had a bet with an investment advisor guy. I'm like, S&P is going to break 700 to the downside. He's like, no way. Guy still owes me the beer. He never pulled up. But deadbeat. But but you know, it's just the math. And so the math will lead you and keep you out of trouble so many times if you just pay attention and do the work. And you know, based on the earnings and what we were expecting earnings to come in at for the year, or the standard multiple of kind of the low in a market, Donald, and we were going to break 700. Just that was easy. So the question was really highly different. And this time it was really, you know, you can always feel the froth. And I know I've heard Brian Burke, our buddy, talked about that too. And his is more gut-based, but you can measure it as well. Like I said, price-to-rent ratio is a great way. You know, are there dollars that you're of income costing you a lot more money? And does that even make sense in the cap rate compression? It's just the educational platforms, the number of attendees at some of those things and their backgrounds. And you see these deals really were being cobbled together by four or five KPs or GPs. You know, none of them really had their own balance sheets. But together they looked okay. And they're all living in different states and they also have full-time jobs and just know, okay, these guys, you know, think this is a quick get rich way. And it was for some, but if you're not paying attention full time and some of these deals, as you know, it can get away from pretty quickly. And I've seen that happen to some really smart guys, sadly, because they're friends, but you just have to, you really have to pay attention, especially in the space that we're in. As you mentioned, our portfolio is heavily focused on workforce health and Class C stuff. And if you're not on that all the time, it can be messy.
Yeah.
But it's also a clear path to the money as far as I'm concerned. It's, you know, look at what's happened the last few years and transaction volume seized up, you know, dropped probably 80, 90%. And, you know, if you were planning on flipping the property and that's going to pull with a higher valuation than the default rate, your host, they weren't run out of time. They'd be in trees. And so, sorry, I'm setting the range here.
You know, I want to get into your strategy here in a little bit, but one of the things I wanted, you touched on before was systemic failure. And, you know, you know more about this than I, but it seemed when Silicon Valley Bank, what we're going on, what now, 2 years ago or a year, 18 months ago, and that sort of, but there's a lot of banks out there today that have a ton of debt on their books. And I know a lot of people are shorting their stocks. And so it just gives me like this, like, yes, we've learned from the 08, but has that then caused us to not let it fail when you need it to let it fail, when it's like, it's so, I guess my question is, should we thinking more about like, oh, you know, we're in the clear, or like, is there more stuff there that we just don't know about because we just aren't told as consumers? When you look at like, okay, yes, you got sponsors that were inexperienced, but you got banks floating those debts, those deals, right? And there's a lot of that out there.
Yeah, you know, I think it's an absolute reality that most of these banks have heavy damage to their portfolio or to their loan portfolio. And a lot of the loans are values are underwater under the unpaid balance. The reason I think that Silicon Valley didn't create a chain reaction, and it did start to, there were a couple that failed right off the bat. There were three that in aggregate, their assets, I think, were more than the 08 failures. But they changed the rules in 08 and 09 after the financial crisis for accounting for banks, where they did not have to mark things to market. And so I think that is what's allowing the banks this time to extend and pretend longer than they did in the last financial crisis that we saw. And so, because we definitely, you know, being known as distressed situation buyers, we have had multiple lenders reach out to us with problems that they would like us to help them solve. And some of them are just not solvable, because a couple of phases to this, you know, we see is operators are in trouble, hold on as long as they can. They empty their pockets trying to keep that asset or do capital calls. If things don't turn around and the market doesn't improve, then they start trying to work with banks that they will ultimately get to the point where the banks start taking the assets back. And that's the phase we're in right now, because we're seeing a number of bank don't assets where before the lenders were reaching out to us, or the owners were reaching out to us saying, hey, you know, this is a problem, can you help us solve it? So now there are a number of them that are bank owned, but the banks are still kind of denying the absolute need for a write down. We're still at the point of denial, I think. You know, one in particular we looked at, and we've had this offered by two different lenders, but they said, you know, just take over unpaid balance. You don't have to bring any equity to the table. We'll give you, you know, 5 years, and, you know, we'll drop the interest rate on the note to make it easier for you, but we just can't take a write down. And so, but the reality is, even within 5 years, I did not have confidence that we could grow it to the level of the unpaid balance, because it's just so far above where the reality was. You know, the property should have probably traded for in the 40s per door, and because of its condition, and they were trying to get, I think it was around 100 a door. Like, that's just not going to happen. And happy to look at other deals if you have them, but that one's not one we're going to take.
Well, yeah, it's so interesting. You say
$5,000 a door or above or something. You know, yeah, we you know, give me time and we'll grow through it. And you know, it's like a free call option for the company, because we would not bring in equity partners.
But talk to me about like why you think that's the sentiment has changed. In, because I've noticed the same thing, right? Like beginning of 2024, everyone's, oh, the dam's breaking, the wall's breaking, here we go, it's going to happen, there's a lot more deals starting to hit the market. And then it was really like a fishing exercise to get LOIs to then go back and negotiate with the banks. And everyone was saying, look, it's not worth the bank balance, not worth it. I looked at a lot of deals that just isn't worth. And the number one thing you kept hearing is that we're not going to do a short sale. We're not going to do a short sale. I'm now seeing that change tones a little bit in the last 6 months.
It's always reaching the point where they have to face reality at some point, depending on their capital source. And they just resist it as long as they can. But
do you think more of it's coming?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's pretty bad deals. I mean, you and I know a bunch of operators, and I don't think any that were all fixed rate. I mean, we fortunately were, because I'm just so paranoid with risk, and it just seemed like asymmetrical risk to me, but especially with my inflation views. Yeah, there's more coming, because the banks will have to at some point accept reality or become landlords, and they don't want to be landlords. So... you know, all the suckers, all the new kids got wiped out. And so, you know, they're not going to be people who are willing to pay $100,000 for a $40,000 door asset.
But let's pivot and talk about your views on inflation, because that's been big on the lips of, you know, my generation, right? Like I was born, like the last big inflationary stuff we had was in the 70s. And now, you know, it's been whatever, 30, 40 odd years since that happened. And now we're in an environment where it happened very quickly. And, you know, I feel like in general, the cost of living across the globe, whether you're in Australia or LA or Mexico or Europe, it's freaking expensive, right? Things are really expensive. And I don't see that coming back down any, like the thing with inflation is that like it goes up, the rate goes up and the rate comes down, but the value of the cost still keeps going up, right? It doesn't.
Even if we're at 2%, right? Still 2% right. on top of all that.
That's right. From before, that's right. So yeah. what's, you know, start the layman's at the beginning of where you think inflation is. Do we have it under control? Is it, you know, we head in the right direction or are we going in the wrong direction?
You know, it depends how you measure inflation. If you're using the CPI, I think they'll ultimately at some point show that it's under control based on the CPI. The CPI is a bit of a farce in the calculation, though, as you and I have discussed. It's a Frankenstein number that doesn't really represent real life. And that's by design. They've changed it over 24 times over the years. And every time it results in a lower calculation, shocker. But, when we were printing 9% on the CPI a couple years ago, owner's equivalent rent comprises a third of CPI, which is their representation for costs of housing for people. And at that point in time, when we were printing 9%, they were showing 2% on owner's equivalent rent increase, which is absurd because literally prices where I am right here had doubled. You know, I don't know of a market that wasn't increasing rents upper single or double digits. And so to say it's 2% is just disingenuous. And but they know that most people don't dig into the numbers. And so the reality is our country has lived beyond its means for decades, many decades, ever since we went off the gold standard. And ever since that point, they've been debasing the currency because they only have a handful of choices. I mean, the math is at the point now where the debt's not repayable in current dollars. And so if they raise, they could do 5 things, I guess. I always used to say 4, but there's kind of a new one on the list that they think they're going to achieve. One is cut expense, right? You can't cut enough expense, as we've seen with Doge and everything. I mean, Musk, whether you like him or not, he's one of the smartest guys in the world, and certainly one of the richest. And he brought all the smartest people to bear that he could, and the system just puked on him. You know, he was finding all this waste and fraud, and nobody wanted to end it because there's so much grift. And so I don't believe expense reduction is going to happen. It certainly can't happen in sufficient quantities. And I've always felt that way. I was a little bit hopeful under Doge, but that's waned. Because it went from a $2 trillion target to a $1 trillion target. Now I think it's a couple hundred billion. So, you know, that's not even a handful of days interest for us. And so that's not going to happen. They could raise taxes or increase taxes on the rich. Well, you know what happens? Money is fungible. And so rich people leave. France went in that the hard way. They try to create these wealth taxes and all the billionaires left the country. So it's, there's an interesting hedge fund story. There's a hedge fund manager in New Jersey and they kept squeezing the income taxes and squeezing them. And he finally decided to move. He moved to Florida. It impacted their budget 9%, the one guy moving. And so they tried to beg him to come back. I'm like, are you kidding me? You're sharp your colors. I'm not coming back. And so it's great down here. It's nice and warm. So, you know, you can't get there from raising taxes. I mean, the math doesn't work. They could take 100% wealth tax of all their wealth and it wouldn't pay off debt. So what are the other options? One is just an explicit default where they just say, hey, you know, we're not going to pay you, but, that's not going to happen. There's a lot of reasons are kind of beyond the scope of this, but, that's not really an option. The other is to inflate. And inflation is much more hidden. It's much more difficult to discern. You know, if you're inflating at mid to upper single digits, people don't really notice. But it's when you get to, 20, 30%, they really start to get pitchforks and torches out. And arguably, when we were printing 9% on CPI a couple of years ago, everything I was buying was up 25 and 30%. It's not because I was buying luxury goods. I mean, it's at the grocery store. And so, I think that was the reality of the number because almost every time my wife would come home from the store and complain, like, well, how much was it before? And she'd tell me, like, it's about 30%. That makes sense. And so, that's where I think it really was. And there were many people that do some even calculations based on the old way the government used to calculate the CPI. And that still shows mid to upper teens, just based on the government's own prior manipulated calculations. So I think, and then the last option, the fifth one is to grow your GDP faster than you grow the debt. And problem with that, though, is GDP is growing debt's been growing at about 10 to 11% per year. And I'm not sure I've ever seen a period when the GDP grows that much. And so, I wish them well, but I don't think it's a viable plan. So I'm counting on high and sustained inflation, even though it's going to be understated by CPI. And that's what I'm positioning for. I mean, the administration has told us, right? I mean, they flat out told us they want a weaker dollar to improve trade balances. And, you know, Bessem's told us, Trump's told us, you know, everybody's telling us that. And so why not just believe that that's what they're going to do and position for it?
That doesn't solve the problem, right? So what, let's bring it full circle. What is your then views over the next 3, 4, 5 years on where we head with inflation? And it sounds like everyone's just living with the debt. It is what it is. Like, it sounds like you sort of, you know, I'm not, you people have tried to solve it. And so what, you just live in a high debt world, and then inflation just continues to wreak havoc?
I mean, we're reaching a point where it is getting pretty critical. I mean, based on a lot of research and data, once you cross 120, possibly 130% GDP, there's really no going back, and bad things start happening. And we're over 120 right now. So we've already kind of tricked the wire, and the world's noticing. I mean, the post-World War II, the U.S. dollar became world reserve currency, and you know, there's some negatives that come with that, and one of them is the ability to abuse it like crazy, which we've done, and live beyond your means, because everybody still has to have dollars. Well, in, was it first quarter of 21 or 22? I forget. I think it's 22. We did the sanctions on Russia for attacking Ukraine. That was a flare gun in the world. That is a line that we had never crossed financially. What we did was we literally took hundreds of billions of dollars of theirs that they had in U.S. dollar reserves, which when you say U.S. dollar reserves, it's usually held in treasuries, and we froze them. We just took it from them. And like, wait a minute, those are our reserves, and you stole them. And so we're like, yeah, but we don't want you to do what you're doing. Well, so what happened was the whole world observed that and said, well, okay, if that's the line you're going to cross, then we don't want to hold your debt because you could just freeze it. And so we don't want dollar reserves. So immediately the chart of central bank reserves was of U.S. dollars was down to the right and still continues that way. And it's just dropping every quarter after quarter after quarter. And the central banks are now graciously buying precious metals and, you know, largely gold and not silver, because silver is not worth enough for them to accumulate. It just takes up too much space. So, and that has now crossed where gold is now held more as a percent of reserves than dollars are. And, you know, that's a trend that I don't think is going to change. You've got the BRICS coming with their new currency, and, you know, they comprise a much larger component of world GDP than the U.S. does. Together they do, at least. And so it's an interesting trend, and it doesn't mean we won't be the reserve currency anymore. It just means at minimum, there's less demand for dollars. And if there's less demand for dollars, the purchasing power declines, and which is the same as inflation. So the other thing to consider with all this debt, I mean, it's you know, $37.3 trillion now. The interest carry on that, and it's IO, you know, in the real estate lingo, is, you know, already over $1.2 trillion, and all that debt is resetting. You know, every month, some of that debt's resetting at the new interest rates that are higher. And that's one of the reasons Trump has beaten the drum about lowering interest rates. It's because it is bankrupting even further the U.S. government. And so they can't afford to make the interest payments. So, you know, even if they hold rates where they are right now for another year, that 1.2 will go to 1.5, 1.6. And, you know, you have to consider we're only collecting about $4 trillion, and we're spending $6 already. So, you know, 1.6, 1.7 is a huge percentage of four. And, you know, you just, countries can't continue to do that. That's when empires start to fail. You have to start giving up stuff because not everybody will take your money anymore.
Well, but that's a good question. Who then comes back and gives up stuff? Because, you know, you keep hearing that the US is the world mattress for, you know, bonds and all that sort of investable dollars. But what I'm hearing from you is just, it's not necessarily that people don't like US treasuries, it's just they're reallocating their percentage of reserve cash into other physical metals, right? Like gold.
I would say they don't like US treasuries. I mean, they're net sellers. And so, you know, they're not buying any anymore. And, well, and really the only people that matter are the central banks because of the size.
Yep. Well, I guess what I was trying to get is just a recalibration of what people are willing to take on. You're more expert than I, but are they taking on zero treasuries or just dumping some less instead of having 80% of their reserve in US treasuries, they have 50%. You know, like it's still some. It's just
they haven't taken it to zero, but they're not buying anymore. And right. So when they mature, they get their money and they go put it somewhere else.
Fast forward 10 years, Bruce, where's your crystal ball show us on inflation and how does the multifamily market look in your mind in 10 years' time?
To me, I mean, outside of precious metals, I think it's one of the best inflation hedges available. I love the risk reward of it. I want to be in hard assets because even 5 years from now, I'm not allowed to guarantee, but if I could, I would guarantee you that a dollar today will purchase, or a dollar 5 years from now will purchase less than a dollar will today. And so I want to find something that's a store of value for those dollars and try to make a return that's higher than the inflation rate. So we have a net positive real return. I think that's very achievable in multifamily. You know, AI can't kill it. It can only help it become more efficient. And so it's not an industry at risk for that. You know, I know that current administration is trying to bring manufacturing back in the States. I mean, strategically, we saw during COVID, that is absolutely needed, at least in certain industries like pharmaceuticals and medical devices and things of that nature, at minimum. We shouldn't be buying components from our enemies that go into our number one weapons. That's probably not a good idea, but that's what we're doing. So some manufacturing makes sense to bring back, and that's going to create increased demand for workforce housing. So that's one of the reasons we're positioned where we are. I like the other reason, like risk reward of it is commercial can be tied to business cycles. Retail, same. You know, office, I had no idea the paradigm was going to shift with COVID. Everybody working kind of from home and having fewer needs for office space. But at the same time, I knew it was business cyclical and I didn't want my investable assets tied to just business cycles. I wanted to be able to control it better than that. And so I think residential or specifically, multifamily is a good way to do that because people have to have a home. And but you have to be thoughtful about where you're buying. And where we buy, we look at supply that's coming online over the next few years. We look at affordability rational relative to national averages so that there is room to raise rents. Austin is a sexy market. I love going there, but it got to the point after a few years of those rent increases that people just couldn't afford them. And so it was hard to get further increases from them. And you didn't know that 5 years ago, but you can look at how much room there is between affordability on the national average and where kind of your market is. And they may not like the rent increases, but they can afford them based on the averages. And so we hone in on details like that to make sure we're in markets that don't have risks that are going to hit us in the face. And say this, we left some markets in Florida, but I just think there's asymmetrical risk there. At some point over the next 5 to 10 years, several hurricanes are going to come through in a row, and insurance could become a real problem. It could double or triple. We've seen it happen, and you can handle a 20% increase. You can't handle a double or triple, and that destroys the value. And so, in spite of us loving the fundamentals of some of those markets, we find it uninvestable for our risk tolerance.
You're only in Oklahoma, right?
Yeah, currently we're only in Oklahoma and only in the two primary markets, Oklahoma City and Tulsa. And it's not that we love Oklahoma so much. We used to invest in Dallas. We just found that the competition is so extensive here that and it's hard to get a competitive advantage for us because initially I thought I'd buy a bunch of different markets for diversification purposes. But ultimately, what I found the business model we're executing or finding a lot of success with is concentrating in a handful of markets gives us a huge competitive advantage because we took property management in the house 2.5 years ago just because we couldn't find anybody competent. And, we have probably 50 or 60 employees in that part of the business. And every one of those employees worked in 5 or 10 properties before they joined us. And so they know these assets, and our head of asset management will just send out a message to the team and say, hey, has anybody worked this property before? And we'll get a whole download of data that the broker doesn't even know. So, there's a pipe under building 6 that always leaks and causes a backup. The building has to shut off and, all this, just intelligence that if you had that kind of insider information in the stock market, you would get arrested. In real estate, it's fair game. And so we have that. It also allows us to know every single broker in the market, and then they know us, the lenders know us, and they know those are our markets and we know them well. We've had rich lenders contact us about deals that aren't our deals, but just that they're quoting in certain markets that we're in. to see our view on their business plan and whether we think they can actually exit in that particular submarket at where they say. And we just give them feedback based on our experience and what we know. So I think that that creates a situation where we can more effectively affect the outcome for investors and control more different things that you couldn't control if you just own one asset in some city that you don't travel to very often. I mean, we have our head of asset management is at these properties every day. Not every single one every day, but within a week, she's at every single property. And not much gets past you when you're on it that closely. And it's close enough where we could go up there and we do. We're very active and hands-on because buying distressed, it's really heavy lift those first couple of years. So it takes a lot of project management and patience. But it's, again, if you fix something that's broken, it's going to be worth more. And so we've had a great success with our track record because of that.
Right. Awesome. Well, Bruce, we come to the end of the show. We like to dive into the top five investing tips. You ready to get into it?
Sure. Yeah.
Question number one, mate, is what's the daily habit you practice to keep on track towards your goals?
I would say beginning the morning every day after I feed the dogs, I usually make breakfast for myself. I sit down with my laptop and I just start reviewing financial news. Not usually mainstream sources, but independent sources that I find credible and have tested over the years that are unbiased. And it helps me form my macro thesis and either continue to validate it or telling me to step on the gas and buy more assets. Or if I start to see conflicting data points, you really want to dig into those and make sure that there's not some sort of flaw with the thesis. For us, we're just macro, we're top down. And that's actually why, like I said, I'm spending so much time on multifamily. It's not just because I went to a conference and this was a strategic decision. And so, if that thesis starts to change, then we need to know.
Yep. Question number two has been, who's the most influential person in your career to date?
Actually, I'll be quick, but I'll give you two. One, I went to a conference before I ever was in this industry. I was just considering and trying to learn. And they always have lunch breakouts. So I sat down next to this guy, and you may have heard this story read for me, but he was an old contractor. And I asked him, hey, what advice would you give somebody just interested in getting in this industry? And he said, just buy something, buy anything. He said, even if it's your worst deal you ever buy, you'll learn so much for it that you'll be off and running and you will have overcome the hurdle that most people never cross, and that's getting started. So that'd be one guy that was influential. I don't even know his name. But the other is probably a prof that I had in grad school. He was editor of a Emerging Market Quarterly, I think it was, and always had these quantitative strategies being sent to him. And I did a couple directed studies with him and where we were just one-on-one and we were doing all these analysis. So I learned a lot of what not to do when you're analyzing things. And I think that taught me a lot of discipline with the numbers, both that, kind of went forward with the hedge fund as well as with that real estate investing.
Love it. Question number three, what's the most influential tool in your business? Could be a physical tool or a piece of, tech that you're running the business on. What is it?
I think technology to some extent is fungible, whether it's, organizational tools or anything like that. I would say our biggest tools are capital and our reputation. On the capital front, we're known to be a well-capitalized firm. I mean, we aren't scrambling to find investors to come up with our escrows. We can put down a nice check and let it go hard if we're committed to the deal. Having the ability for the firm to show, an eight-figure proof of funds gives us a leg up on acquisitions because it's a solid step comfort that you have the ability to close. And on the reputation front, I would say both from reputation for strong operations as well as, let me explain that. So, having a reputation for strong operations doesn't always help us as a seller because some buyers think I can't operate as well, but it certainly helps us with the lenders. And when we're buying a distressed deal, they have the confidence in us because they've seen us do it before. And some of the lenders actually have invested with us now personally, which is kind of funny. But, the other part of the reputation piece would be just you're being known to do what you say you're going to do. Counterparties have confidence in us in contracting with us because they know that we do have that reputation. We don't play games. We're not going to try to reach trade. We figure out the value before we put out our offer. And when we show up at a C asset, we're not going to be surprised it's a C asset. It's going to have some issues.
Nice. Last question is, where can people reach you to continue the conversation that will be in your sphere? Where do they go?
So, I don't post a lot on social media. The only thing I'm on is LinkedIn, as you know, and it's always posting about macroeconomic issues. You'll never see our deals on there or anything else. But feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. And then separately, elkhornpartners.com is our website where you can go and see our portfolio. And you know, if you want more information, you can reach out through that.
Awesome. Well, Bruce, I want to thank you so much for jumping on the show today. I just want to reflect some of the things I took away. I think your ability, since I've known you, because I know you personally, is the way to assess that top-down risk from a macro perspective is really, really quite your strong suit. And I know that's not something that you were born with. You've gone and developed it over the years, and you're a person who is very studied in the world of global economics. And I think that's a really good breath of fresh air, some would say, because you get a lot of people who are so, I'm just in it for getting rich quick or whatever it might be, but you have a calculated approach of how you want your business to go. And I think that discipline has helped you where you are today. So that's what I took away from today's show. I don't know you personally, but I don't say that lightly. I say it because it's admirable, right? And I think that the listeners of the show, just in the way how calculated you are, but you make it in a calculated decision to go out and do something for a specific outcome is really quite based on data, is very, very, very disciplined approach. So thank you for jumping on the show.
Yeah, and I think that's totally true. I mean, we're very disciplined. We try to stick to it. I mean, we had foreclosure shown to us the other day. It didn't meet our size requirements. It was too big. And so we just passed, even though it was, kind of a high leverage loan assumption deal. We just, we don't break our rules. I'm so risk averse. That's probably why I'm so paranoid about looking at all the data. But, I will say, if we have a high conviction view, which I do right now on inflation being high and sustained for many years, and is my biggest mistake investing over the past has been not being big enough on the trade. And, my financial crisis, I told you, I made bets with people, it's going to break 700. Why would I was in a position to get windfall gains for that? And, what I see unfolding now is kind of like a slow motion versus the stock market. And it's playing out exactly as we expect. And so I'm trying not to make the same mistake. And we just added an analyst and we're looking at tons of deals right now. We want to get bigger and we want to get bigger sooner than later. A lot of people are waiting because they think, oh, this is a difficult period right now. And this is the time, in my view, when we should be buying before inflation picks up again, whether they actually reflect it or not. But you have to have the pricing cover in the market you're in. You have to fix as many costs as you can. Otherwise you'll get smoked. But that's kind of our view, and that's what we're trying to do is, we're not going to force a deal, as you can probably tell from our discipline in the past. But we're trying to find the deals that do work for us, and we're not trying to call a bottom. I care a little bit if this is the low or not, but we're just going to buy through it. And I think even in 07, we sold in 07. That's great, but I'd love to buy at 07 prices right now. Wouldn't you?
Right. If you had the long term debt on it, I think is the biggest thing, right? So
yeah. Right, for sure, right. For sure. Yeah, it was good to see you again, dude.
No, mate, thank you for jumping on the show. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll catch up very, very soon.
Right, see ya.
Well, there you have it. Another cracking episode, jam-packed with some incredible advice from Bruce. If you do want to check him out, it's Bruce Fraser, Fraser, on LinkedIn, and check him out at elkhornpartners.com. For everything going on over there, very disciplined guy. Follow his stuff about the macro trends that are going on in the world today, how that inflation is going to affect us, not infect us. Of how our thesis should be of investing in the future. If you like the show, give the show a 5-star review, share it with your friends, and we're going to do it all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.